Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Who would have guessed that along with cigars and cognac, swing would come back into fashion? Big band dance halls adapted to an end-of-the-century taste are springing up everywhere. Today on Talking History, we'll take a look back at the 1930s and 40s, when swing was really king. But before we do that, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. On April 5, 1614, American Indian Princess Pocahontas married English colonist John Rolfe. Yes, the same Pocahontas, Indian princess and daughter of the great chief Powhatan, and as the subject of a recent Disney film that saved Captain John Smith's life 5 years earlier by flinging herself over Smith's prostrate body waiting to be decapitated, pleading with her father not to execute him. Pocahontas was 14 when she saved Smith, and for the next 5 years, she worked to keep peace between the Virginia settlers and her native kinsmen. She married at age 19, moved to England, and was received at court and lionized by English high society, only to contract smallpox and die in 1617. Turning to items of interest in the news, a recent joint announcement from the German government and a dozen major German firms, including BMW and Volkswagen, took another step toward settling claims arising from the use of forced labor during the Nazi era. The announcement included plans to establish what would be called the German Companies Foundation Initiative, Remembrance, Responsibility, and Future. The foundation will consist of a humanitarian fund to aid former forced laborers and other Nazi victims, as well as to assist projects concerned with drawing lessons from the experiences of those in Nazi Germany. The businesses hope this will help bring an end to the costly legal actions being brought against them by Holocaust survivors and Jewish organizations. And if the 1960s was the decade of hippies and civil rights, and the 70s are remembered for Watergate and leisure suits, what do Americans remember about the 1980s? That's precisely the question the U.S. Postal Service is asking as it puts together its Celebrate the Century series, a collection of stamps with 15 stamps for each decade of the 1900s. So far, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Vietnam War Memorial, the movie E.T., personal computers, and cable TV have been chosen as most representative of the 80s. The number one choice by voters, however, is a stamp depicting video games. You're listening to Talking History.
Don't mean a thing if you ain't got that swing.
Swing is back. The big band sound can be heard once again on radio stations across the nation, and dance halls featuring swing are everywhere. Young people who weren't even born in the 30s and 40s are waxing nostalgic about an era they never knew. But just what was the age of swing about? How did the music relate to the times? Here to answer these and other questions concerning the swing era is Creighton professor Eileen Dugan, who will be speaking to today's special guest, Louis Ehrenberg.
In the late 1930s and 1940s, a new musical sound swept America, swing. Swing, the New York Times declared, was the tempo of our time, and with such band leaders as Benny Goodman, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, and Glenn Miller, in the minds of many, swing became synonymous with America and her ideals. But swing was not only a new musical form. Swing also came to be associated with new cultural and political perspectives as well. With us today to discuss the swing era is Dr. Louis Ehrenberg, professor of history at Loyola University of Chicago. Professor Ehrenberg is the author of the recent Swing in the Dream, Big Band Jazz, and the Rebirth of American Culture. Welcome, Professor Ehrenberg.
Oh, glad to be here.
Just as a starting point, what is swing?
Well, musicians and critics debated this endlessly. I would say that it's organized, arranged improvisation, usually, but not always, in a big band form. So that's the musical side of it. It's associated with bigger bands in which the arrangers played a major role. An arranger such as Fletcher Henderson was very important for the whole swing era. Often written scores, the ensemble playing of the organized sections, the reed section or the brass section or the rhythm section were very important. And within the arrangement, there would be some room left over for individual improvisation or soloing.
Now, can we point to a specific beginning of the swing era?
Well, we can point to a beginning of the swing era, although pointing to the beginning of swing is harder. Most historians, and I suppose I would agree, date the swing era to August of 1935, when Benny Goodman's big band traveled out to the Palomar Ballroom in Los Angeles after a disastrous road tour in which the band was not accepted. And to the surprise of the band, this was their last stop, their last stand. They were a huge success. People stopped dancing. They crowded around the bandstand as the big band played spirited versions of the Fletcher Henderson arrangements. And it was after this that Benny Goodman started to be called, or was called, the King of Swing, when swing bands now suddenly took on that name, when new bands formed. All sorts of big bands started forming, playing a music called swing. They began touring. Young people were very excited about it. So I would date it to that August of 1935. The reason I say that it's harder to date when swing began is that before the mass public accepted it, understood it, realized it was there, black bands like Duke Ellington's or Fletcher Henderson's were playing the same music, but to smaller crowds. And they really pioneered the music. And the era, the swing era, is when it becomes a mass phenomenon for whites as well as blacks, when it's all over the musical press. It is very important for a whole generation of young people.
Now, many people tend to think of the jazz age and the swing era as the same thing, but what was the difference between these two periods in music and in politics and in culture?
Well, I think one thing is that the jazz of the 1920s had much less respectability associated with it because the best music was black. It was played in nightclubs, which because of prohibition had an illegal aura, you know, knock and tell them Joe sent you. Raids were often occurred. So the music was associated with, in the minds of many people, immorality. By the early 30s, the black bands were working on the big band form. They were developing a 4-4 beat. They were creating arrangements for a full band that utilized the different sections very smoothly, and they had found a way to open up holes in the arrangements for the individual soloist. And that means that by the time the white bands take over or enter into the swing phenomenon, they are playing a music that is heavily black and has that sense of propulsion and drive that 20s music doesn't have. 20s music often sounds vertical to me, whereas the swing music is very much horizontal, moving on towards some future. I see it as rather utopian, and to respond to how does it fit with the rest of culture in that period or politics, I think it very much is part of the democratic culture and democratic spirit of the 1930s that we see in radical politics, we see in New Deal politics, we see in a growing union movement. And I think that the primacy of the big bands, of groups acting together for a common purpose, is very much a parallel to what is happening in other areas of life. The social, the group, is much more important than the individual. And the individual finds freedom, in this case the individual soloist, in the context of a larger group or corporate entity or family, all of which are terms that people used in discussing the band. Moreover, the political connection is quite explicit because many of the critics who wrote about jazz in the new swing magazines or wrote about swing in the new jazz magazines, depending on how you want to put it, were radicals, or certainly political liberals aligned with the New Deal. And while they could write about the music as a pop phenomenon, about its relationship to youth culture. They were also very concerned in educating the public as to the black roots of the music and to the discrimination against black musicians. This ultimately, I think, had the effect of starting the integration of the jazz band or the swing band. And here, too, it's Benny Goodman who initiated in a compromised form a kind of integration when he first brought the great pianist Teddy Wilson into his trio that traveled with the band, and then the quartet when he brought in Lionel Hampton on vibes. But he continued to bring in African-American musicians and was regarded as a pioneer. He had Charlie Christian on guitar in the sextets and other black musicians. Plus, he played the arrangements of Fletcher Henderson, who also later in Goodman's career in 1939 played in the band. So I see swing as part of this larger democratization that's going on, a new spirit in culture, and in a way, a new vision of what America was like. After all, it was Goodman who was Jewish, who was playing with African-American musicians, but also Italian-American musicians, and musicians from all around the country in what were considered in what was considered the all-American band or the all-American style of music. And that's where the critics come in. They really push the notion that swing is America's music, swing is the music of democracy. And if you believe that, then the question is, well, what should the music look like? And someone like Goodman and someone like the black musicians as well were saying, well, it should look a lot darker than previous jazz bands had looked, certainly the ones led by whites, such as Paul Whiteman in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that, for example, Benny Goodman was achieving some integration in his band, but you also talk about the bands up in Harlem, and up at the Savoy and at the Cotton Club. And how separate were the worlds of black and white swing?
Well, there is a tremendous amount of segregation in the period. It is a segregated era, so that black bands, for example, could not get on radio for commercial spots, that is, for regular commercial broadcasts. They couldn't have, like, a weekly show that was nationwide. They could do specials. They could appear live. They could have one-shots. But usually these were sustainers, as they were called in that period, non-commercial broadcasts. And this is because the advertisers were afraid of turning off white Southerners and other less enlightened whites around the country. Well, this meant that black bands had to work all the time, and often they worked in segregated settings. The white bands usually got the cream theater engagements, the best ballroom engagements, the longer runs, because they could attract a much larger audience of white folks who were in the majority. However, what I see going on in the 30s is that slowly black bands are playing venues formerly white. They are beginning to crack the top hotels now and again. Count Basie plays the William Penn Hotel in Pittsburgh, for example, the first black band to do so, at least as far as I know. Duke Ellington plays a whole variety of venues, theaters, clubs, ballrooms that were never before played by black bands. You also see black and white bands playing battles of the bands together, appearing together, in other words, in particular venues. You also see them playing the same repertoire. Sometimes this is out and out stealing by white bands or white musicians, but not always. There's a respect also for the music as such, and black and white bands are playing these things. Chick Webb is playing some of the same things that Benny Goodman is doing, and Benny Goodman goes up to play a battle of the bands with Chick Webb at the Cotton Club, Chick Webb's home turf. Moreover, there are integrated, starting to be anyway, integrated special jazz concerts, usually for the winners of the big, whether Downbeat polls or Esquire magazine's polls, which start during the war, or the various black newspapers like the Pittsburgh Courier and the Chicago Defender start their own polls, and the winners play together. Often there are whites and blacks. So that you're beginning to see a sense that these musicians are musicians first, despite the segregation, which is there. I mean, I don't want to minimize it because that's an undercurrent that the black bands, of course, feel more. The white bands can look around and feel themselves integrating if they have allowed one black musician in the band or a black singer to play with the band. But for black musicians, most of whom travel in all black units, they still face horrible conditions, especially in the South. Yet, there is a breaking down of the barriers that occurs that challenges some of the whiteness and segregation. And I think the two trends, one of segregation, the other of bending those barriers, comes to a head during the war.
Now, in terms of segregation and breaking down the walls and such, and also swing being accepted, you tell the story of that wonderful night that Benny Goodman made his debut at Carnegie Hall.
Oh, yes, the Carnegie Hall concert, first of all, was, for its day, a remarkably integrated phenomenon. First of all, he had his trio and quartet playing that night. Then he had members of Count Basie's orchestra, including Basie, playing on the stage. Then he had members of Duke Ellington's band, not Ellington, who didn't want to participate, playing in various jam sessions and arranged group playing and so on. And this is, you know, a huge event. It's a big success. And then afterward, Goodman, some of his family members, some of the musicians, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie rush uptown to the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem, where Basie plays a major battle of the bands with Chick Webb. And so that you can see that there's a whole array of institutions and activities that are interpenetrating. Moreover, what's interesting is that that night, I think it was January 18th, 1938, swing is being played at Carnegie Hall, and it's the same music that Goodman would normally play in a dance hall or a theater. This is very unlike Paul Whiteman's concert of 1924, the Aeolian Hall concert, in which he really tried to make jazz respectable with semi-classical music and all sorts of light operetta airs and so on. This Goodman performance is straight out swing. Plus, by going up to Harlem, to the home of Happy Feet, as it was often called, it's clear that this maybe concert music is rooted in dance halls, is rooted in African-American culture, is rooted in the street. I think this is a very different kind of statement than what Paul Whiteman was doing in the 20s.
What do you think of the recent resurgence of swing?
Well, I get asked this all the time, and I suppose I should have a snappy answer. Well, one, of course, I'm very pleased because obviously people call me up and ask me this. But the other thing is that it seems to me that it's hard to tell where this is going to go, okay? This could either be the start of some new kind of movement that will have long-lasting effects, or it's just nostalgia. That is, the question is how much authentic creativity is going into it and how much is just going to be aping styles of the past. The other thing is that much of it isn't swing. It's jump music from the 40s or a Louis Jordan-style rhythm and blues product, which is very close to early rock and roll. So in a way, it's like rock and rollers rediscovering the roots of rock and roll. But it's also a roots music in the sense that it was big beat, it was for dancing, it preceded rock and roll, it was youth culture, and I think there's an attempt to go back to something people can dance to, and that is much more optimistic than the popular music of our own day. For example, I think to some extent it's a reaction against some of the depressing qualities of grunge, which was more popular in a time when the economy was not thriving. And also a reaction against rap, which to most white ears seems like being yelled at. Now, I like both grunge and a lot of rap, but I could see where people, a lot of folks, would not find it optimistic, would not be contain much utopian vision about relations between men and women. And I think the swing revival certainly is speaking to dancing between boys and girls. Now, you don't have to be just boys and girls. Boys and boys, girls and girls. But there's something about the relationship in the dance that's very important. And it used to be called touch dancing. Well, touch dancing is back, even though in swing you don't touch all that closely, which means that you could go to all sorts of big events, big communal events, and dance with a lot of people without, you know, the overtone of sexuality. And it seems to me this is a statement, you know, I'm guessing here, but a statement of a desire for a larger kind of social fabric that has been perceived to have unraveled. And so the relations between the couple, the setting in which a people could dance with a lot of folks, and also the sheer exuberance of the music and the dancing, I think speaks to a momentary optimism that may have something to do with the current economic revival.
Okay, well, I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there. Thank you, Professor Ehrenberg.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay, we have been talking with Dr. Louis Ehrenberg, Professor of History at Loyola University of Chicago, author of Swing and the Dream, Big Band Jazz and the Rebirth of American Culture.
Clearly, Americans' penchant for nostalgia is responsible for much of the recent fad of swing music and the big band sound. In recent years, we've nostalgically recalled the culture of the 60s and the 50s, so why not the 40s and the 30s? Is it all harmless enough, or is there a darker side to nostalgia? Here to address that subject in our op-ed of the week is Juliette Gilbert, a freelance writer on American culture, currently completing her PhD in American Studies at Yale University.
For most of the past decade, I've lived down the street from the Smoothie Foundation Garments Factory, a crumbling, nearly defunct girdle concern that once made New Haven, Connecticut, the corset capital of the world. Last year, the company was bought by the Sara Lee Corporation and set its sights on the fresh fields of the postmodern girdle market. Smoothie is now a purveyor of body-shaping garments with names like the Waist Eliminator. Personally, I wouldn't be caught dead in a ditch in a Waist Eliminator, but today's fashion-conscious young woman seems strangely eager to turn back the underpants clock to 1940. Frequently, those eliminated waists are encased in vintage gabardine suits, dating from the Smoothie Factory's first heyday, the 30s and 40s. Now that their elders have succumbed to casual Friday, our nation's youth is embracing torpedo brassieres, cruel shoes, and stuffing 2 pounds of bologna in a 1-pound sack. This baffling trend, of course, is part of retro culture, whose practitioners range from weekend Lindy Hoppers to hardcore, full-time neo-swingers who dress, talk, and drive vintage. For many of its enthusiasts, retro is a conscious act of cultural rebellion. But the retro aesthetic is spreading beyond its countercultural roots, not just to college-age jitterbugs, but to Gap commercials and other mass culture locations. Serious retro aficionados feel that reclaiming America's heyday constitutes a social revolution, a determined rejection of empty consumerism in favor of a more authentic and aesthetic version of American culture. This notion appeals to those of us who have always been dubious about the so-called progress represented by mini-malls and other late 20th century delights. But there's a serious error at the heart of retro logic. The big band era, far from being a miraculous antidote to our throwaway society, is precisely when modern consumer culture hardened into place. But I think there's more to the retro craze than a misinterpretation of recent history. Nostalgia is nothing new, of course, but the shape it takes does tell us something about the present. After all, we could just as easily be sporting powdered wigs and codpieces to express our disaffection with the contemporary moment. The really significant thing about retro is that it fetishizes the low point for American social justice. The big band golden age was not quite so golden if you were an African American living under Jim Crow, or a Japanese American just released from an internment camp, or Rosie the Riveter propelled back into enforced domesticity. Now, I'm not trying to be a killjoy, and I am the first to admit how happy I am that it's now possible at weddings to dance with men younger than my father. But I'd like to think that the America's Golden Age revivalists could spare a moment to think about the downside of the days when girls were girls and men were men. Sure, it's easy to know who you are when you're a smoothie whalebone corset reminds you at every breath, and racial and ethnic divides are enforced by law. But when all is said and done, do we really want to transport ourselves back to 1948, no matter how fabulous the outfits?
You've been listening to Juliet Gilbert, freelance writer, currently living in New Haven, Connecticut. This is Talking History. Related to our show on the swing era, we've chosen for our site of the week a museum exhibit on the jazz age in Paris. Here to tell you more about the exhibit is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Jazz Age in Paris is a traveling exhibit put together by the Smithsonian and will tour the country over the next few years. The exhibition, which covers the era from 1914 to 1940, documents the growth of jazz and the flood of Americans to the City of Lights from World War I to World War II. There are posters, pictures, artifacts, and, of course, music, covering the myriad of writers, artists, photographers, dancers, and musicians inspired by the Jazz Age in Paris. The exhibit will be at the Museum of Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas, from April 24th to July 4th of this year.
Thank you, Cindy. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. Jazz is one of America's great contributions to world culture, not just in the music, but as the exhibit Seeing Jazz suggests, in the art and literature it inspired. Seeing Jazz, organized by the Smithsonian Institution, presents a panorama of artistic and literary responses to this 20th century musical expression. The exhibit consists of 71 paintings, sculptures, drawings, and photographs, as well as numerous literary selections from the jazz age's finest writers. Seeing Jazz will open on April 24th at the Huntington Museum of Art in Huntington, West Virginia. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you will join us next week when we will celebrate Earth Day by looking at the life and work of Rachel Carson. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. ¶¶